turning to Philippians chapter number 2. It seems like we've been away from Philippians for a couple of weeks, but we have been in a sermon series going through the book of Philippians. This is message number 11 in that series, entitled, Don't Die Without Joy. We're going to be looking at Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 to 18. Do all things without murmurings and disputings, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation among whom ye shine as lights in the world. Holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. Yea, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. For the same cause also do you joy and rejoice with me. Reality has consequences, sort of like gravity. It has a certain number of consequences. One of those being I was never able to dunk a basketball. And that was all due to gravity. Maybe barometric pressure, but reality has consequences. Here's another reality. I don't know everything, and I am not always right. Now, those are tough words to say, but most of us would probably agree that they are true of every one of us here today. But even if we accept that statement as a theoretical possibility, you know, well, I don't know everything, theoretically. You know, I'm not right about everything, theoretically. Even if we accept that as a theoretical possibility, we usually don't accept it as readily as a consequential reality. And here's the consequence. If we don't know everything, and if we are not right about everything, then we are ignorant and wrong about some things. I know that's a lot to hit you with this morning. I didn't give you any kind of warning. You probably would have wanted to have a little bit more coffee so you could process this a little bit better. I'm sorry about that. But it is true. So if it's true that we don't know everything, and that we're not right about everything, then sooner or later, at some point, we're going to have to acknowledge that we are, in fact, wrong about something. Well, Paul has a similar reality and consequence for us in this book of the Philippians, this passage that we're looking at. And it means that sooner or later, we are going to have to accept some things that we may not be entirely comfortable with, just like we're not real comfortable with admitting that we are wrong. Well, Paul begins this letter with an update of his situation as a prisoner in Rome. And he wrote of his desire to come to the church at Philippi. He really wanted to see them again. He obviously had a very close relationship and a lot of mutual love between them. But he knew that that might not happen. He knew that because of his situation being as serious as it was, it could very well end in his execution. Now, in chapter 1 and verse 27, he began exhorting them to live worthy of the gospel. And that's whether he's present with them or whether he's absent from them. Now, the last few verses of chapter 1 speak to the suffering that necessarily is involved in the conflict of the gospel that Paul spoke about. This conflict is what they were called to, just as well as Paul was called to, just as well as what each one of us who believe in Jesus Christ is called to. Now, in chapter number 2, he returned to living worthy of the gospel, and he stressed the need for having the mindset of unity and humility where nothing is done out of a desire to elevate oneself over others. In order to do this, in chapter 2 and verse number 5, he exhorted them to have the mindset of Christ, which he went on to explain in verses 6 through 8. Jesus emptied himself, Paul wrote. He completely subjected himself to be the slave of his Father, even to the death of crucifixion. And of course, then Paul pointed out in verses 9 to 11 there that Jesus was and will be vindicated. In other words, it was right for him to empty himself. It was right for him not to cling to glory in order to sacrifice himself to save all those who believe in him. It was right. And he is and will be exalted. Well, Paul then exhorts the church in Philippi to the obedience of Jesus Christ. And he calls them to work out their own salvation in verses 12 to 13. And at the very least, working out their own salvation included all of those imperatives that Paul had given them in this section. So they were to live worthy of the gospel. That's how he started in chapter 1, verse 27. They were to stand firm and strive together in verse 28. Having the same mind, the same love, being of one accord and of one mind in chapter 2 and verse 2. And not working out of strife or vainglory in verse 3. And esteeming others better than themselves, looking on the interests of others in verses 3 and 4, and having the mind of Christ in verse number 5. They are to do this, Paul says, because God works in them. And he had previously written that God began that work in them, and God would complete that work in them in the day of Jesus Christ. So, live worthy of the gospel by living presently in light of the future return of Jesus Christ and his day of reward for believers who will receive full and final glorification. Well, it brings us to verses 12 to 18. And verses 12 to 18 are the conclusion of this first main section of the body of this letter to the Philippians. And the conclusion gives us two particular commands to the church at Philippi in light of what he has written concerning having the mind of Christ. Now, the first command is in verse number 12, where he commands them to work out their own salvation with fear and trembling. And verses 12 and 13 is what we looked at last time we studied here in Philippians. The second command comes in verse number 14, the first verse of our text this morning. And it's obviously connected to the first. Now, in verses 14 to 18, Paul gives that second command, and then he goes on to give two consequences or two results from that second command. And this gets really at the heart of Paul's aim in ministry for the Philippians, just as he wrote back in chapter 1 and verse 25, and having this confidence, I know that I shall abide and continue with you all for your furtherance and joy of faith. Paul aimed in ministering to this church at Philippi that they would make progress, that they would advance, that they would grow in the faith, and that they would come to fullness of joy in Jesus Christ. Well, as Paul brings this section to an end here in verses 14 to 18, we can see that having the mindset of Jesus Christ results in humility and therefore unity in the local church that gives a pure witness to the gospel and to Jesus Christ. So, in other words, what is at stake here? It is their obedience in the short term. It is their faithful corporate witness as a church, and in the long term, their salvation in the day of Jesus Christ. So we want to look at this passage in two parts, in verses 14 to 16, where Paul writes to those in Philippi to be free of complaining and arguing. And in verses 17 to 18, where he exhorts them to live and die with joy. So we'll start in the first part, verses 14 to 16, to be free of complaining and arguing, beginning with verse 14. Do all things without murmurings and disputings. So Paul joins this command. So the first command was work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Then in verse 13, he gives a because it's God which worketh in you. The second command comes in verse 14, do all things without murmurings and disputings. And when you look at this, you realize it's actually the mirror of the command that he gave back up in verse 3 in chapter number 2 when he wrote, "Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory." So there he said, do nothing this way. And here he says, do everything this way. So again, it is the mirror of that command, which obviously ties this entire section together. So as they obey, and as they work out their own salvation, as Paul has described, everything that they do should be free of or without murmurings and disputings. Now, the word for murmuring, it means grumbling, and it indicates even what we might call low-tone mutterings. It means complaining, and it gives the idea of there being ongoing grumblings. It's not just the giving of a single complaint, but more likely would point to a pattern within them. And it is an expressing of, a complaint is an expressing of discontent or dissatisfaction with something or someone and the way that they are or the circumstances are. Now, Paul warned the church at Corinth when he wrote to that church not to follow the example of unbelieving Israel who God killed in the wilderness because of five sins that he lists. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning at verse 6, lust is the first one. Idolatry is the next one in verse 7. Then fornication in verse number 8. Then tempting and trying, testing of God in verse number 9. And then the fifth sin that he gives in verse number 10 is this, murmuring. Murmuring. And when you look at that list of five sins that he says that God destroyed that generation of Israel in the wilderness for, it might seem like murmuring is a little bit out of place. That doesn't really seem that bad, really. But complaining was an expression of discontent and ultimately of their unbelief. It is because they did not believe. It's because they did not trust. And it's because they did not want to obey what God told them to do that they were murmuring and complaining constantly in the wilderness. It was an expression of their rebellion. It was their unwillingness to obey the word of God. Even if they were going through the outward motions, they were still yet revealing in their hearts, I do not want to do this. So Paul's warning to the church at Corinth was, don't be like them. That's an example to learn from, what you call the negative example. Don't do what they did. Now, the word for disputing that Paul uses here is a word that means thoughts or reasonings and really can mean opinions. And it's used in the context of the disciples' argument about which one of them would be the greatest. So in Luke chapter 9 and verse 46, then there arose a reasoning, and that's where the same word is, among them, which of them should be greatest. In other words, the disciples each had their own thoughts. They each had their own opinions, their own ideas about which one of them, which one of their number would be the greatest in the kingdom. And in fact, in Luke chapter 22 and verse 24, there he refers to it as a strife between them. And Mark in Mark chapter 9 and verse 33 refers to it as a dispute among them. In other words, they were arguing amongst themselves about which one of them would be the greatest because they all had different ideas about who it would be. So in this context, this command, do nothing, or rather do all things without murmurings and disputings, is set over against that command in chapter 2 and verse number 3, where they were to do nothing out of proud and selfish ambitions against each other. Look at verse 15. That you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation among whom ye shine as lights in the world. So here Paul gives a consequence of living free of complaining and fighting. Now, the word that's translated that at the beginning of the verse there is a Greek conjunction that it can indicate purpose. It can also indicate a result. Here it's followed by a verb that indicates a state of being, and so it is a result that is being referred to. In other words, Paul is saying, do this, and this will be the result. So if they do all things without murmurings and disputings, then verse 15 will be the result. He says, first of all, that they will be blameless. And the word there means to be irreproachable. In other words, it means that you cannot be charged, not rightly, not truly. You can't be charged with wrongdoing. He also used this word harmless, and the word that is used there means innocent or pure. It was a word that was used in that day. It was used to refer to the purity of unmixed wine or to the purity of unalloyed metal. He also says without rebuke, and that word means to be unblemished. It is actually in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it is the word that is used to describe the requirement for sacrificial animals to be without defect or to be without blemish, like in Numbers chapter 6 and verse number 14. So these words that he's saying here, this blameless and harmless and without rebuke, are describing being true children of God. So what is at stake here is the local church's witness that should be genuine and should not be hypocritical. It should be pure. It should be irreproachable. It should be without blemish. In other words, a congregation internally filled with strife and complaining and selfish ambition is a congregation that cannot witness to the gospel externally without hypocrisy. Paul spoke of some who were preaching Christ not sincerely. They were preaching Christ out of hypocrisy back in chapter 1 we looked at previously. So Paul is not referring here, when he speaks of them being blameless and harmless and so on, he's not referring to any sort of sinless perfection. That's not his point. But what he's referring to is a true Christ-mindedness that is manifested through humility and unity that gives a pure witness to the world around it. Now, Paul goes on here in verse number 15 when he says, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation among whom you shine as lights in the world. And he's actually alluding here to Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse number 5, which is a passage where Moses sang of the unbelieving generation of Israel as a perverse and crooked generation. And actually the word that is translated nation here is not the normal word that is translated nation in the Greek. It's actually a word that does mean generation. So he refers to a crooked and a perverse generation. Well, the Gospels and the book of Acts and the letter to the Hebrews, they all refer to that generation of Israel to whom Christ came as an evil and an unbelieving generation. That generation of unbelieving Israel was paralleled with the rebellious generation that came out of Egypt and died in the wilderness. So by alluding to that generation that Paul is doing here, Paul is thinking about their failure, that generation of Israel to whom the Messiah came, their failure to embrace their Messiah. And the result was their being cut off. In other words, if they had received their Messiah, the kingdom would have been established. And the light would have been set on God's holy hill of Zion that would shine to all of the nations of the earth. Israel was chosen and called by God to be his witnesses to the nations, and they failed that through their unbelief. So one of their failures was manifested through their continual complaining against God and against his messengers that brought God's word to them. So because they rejected the Messiah, they were cut off. And the kingdom is not here. And God is without witness to the nations. And that, of course, is why Jesus started his church, his ecclesia, to be witnesses to the nations in this age of the nations, while Israel is temporarily set aside and remain mainly in unbelief. So this witness will be to Israel as well through his church. In other words, you're really at the core purpose of why Jesus founded a church, of why that churches continue to this day and will continue until the time of his return. So the point is that Paul is charging the church at Philippi to not be like that evil generation of Israel who failed to believe, who failed to obey, and they were cut off. Verse number 16, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. Well, the word of life that Paul refers to, that is the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. Paul wrote that they were to hold it fast. They were to hold it secure. They were to cling to it, to guard it. And there's also a sense to this word that would be almost like holding out or holding up so that others can see. Well, this is how he began this section of commands. If we go back to chapter 1 and verse 27 to 30, only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that ye stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and in nothing terrified by your adversaries, which is to them an evident token of perdition, but to you of salvation and that of God. For unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict which he saw in me and now here to be in me. So this is the aim in all their humility, in all their unity, in all their obedience that Paul is commanding them to. That in having the mind of Christ together, they will hold firmly to the gospel of Jesus Christ and not ruin their witness to the nations by mixing in pride and selfish ambition and complaining and quarreling with one another. All things that he has addressed in this section of the letter. Now, Paul here, in verse number 16, writes, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ. And, of course, that in this verse is a different word than was back in the previous ones. Actually, a preposition here that is using to indicate a goal. And the goal is rejoicing in the day of Christ. Now, we've already seen Paul making this reference to this future day of Christ, this day of account and day of reward for believers. So Paul refers to his ministry to the Philippians here. He refers to it as running and laboring. And no doubt he would include there his sufferings and his grief and all those things that have come upon him. Now back in chapter 1 and verse 25 again, he wrote, and having this confidence, I know that I shall abide and continue with you all for your furtherance and joy of faith. In other words, Paul understood all of the aspects of ministry that he endured, that he underwent, that he had to endure, was for their progress and joy of faith. In other words, that is what it is to be a minister of Jesus Christ. So for Paul to do all that in vain would mean that the Philippians failed to work out their own salvation. They failed to receive reward and glorification in the day of Christ. In other words, they did not truly believe, and they would come to judgment rather than reward. Again, just like that unbelieving generation of Israel that died in the wilderness. So this shows that the bigger picture is not what kind of Christians they will be. but whether they will be Christians at all and not merely false professors. Then we get to the second part, verses 17 and 18, that finish up this conclusion of this particular section of the letter. Verse 17, Paul wrote, "Yea, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all." Now the word for offering that Paul uses here, that if he be offered upon the sacrifice, that word means a libation. It means to be poured out like a drink offering. And it's actually a metaphor of death. Paul used this very same term this way in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse number 6, where he wrote, "For I am now ready to be offered, I'm now ready to be poured out like a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand," where Paul is clearly writing about his death. Well, we also know in this context that Paul has been speaking often about his death. Paul knew that it would be soon, whether it was the end of this particular imprisonment or not. He certainly seemed to have that idea. So Paul is referring again here to his death when he talks about being offered upon the sacrifice and service of their faith. Because he sees this imprisonment, he sees this suffering as the conflict of the gospel that he was called to. Now the word for service that is used here is a word that does actually indicate some sort of a public office or some sort of a public ministry. So here's what Paul is saying here. Paul is saying, if I die in the service of Jesus Christ, bringing the gospel and a faithful example to you Philippians, I will have joy and rejoice with you all. So Paul, as he thinks about his death, he's here again modeling the mindset that he had, the mindset that the Philippians should have. What is the outcome of all these sufferings that he has written about? Well, from a human perspective, it really just can't be good. Where is Paul going to go from here? He's a prisoner in Rome. He has been charged with serious crimes against the empire for which the punishment is execution. This cannot end well, most likely. And that certainly was Paul's view that we saw earlier in the letter. So now Paul is saying, as I presently endure these sufferings for the sake of the gospel and my ministry to you, if I die in this ministry and they have embraced Jesus Christ, they have the mindset of Christ, Paul says, then I have joy and rejoicing with you all. Dying in that ministry means that he fulfilled it. He did what he was called to do. It was not in vain because of the true faith of the church in Philippi. All of the words that he had spent on them, all of the time that he had spent with them, no doubt the tears that he had spent with them, all the communication that they had back and forth and sending Epaphroditus and the time that he had with Epaphroditus that he gets into later. All of these things, Paul says, it was not in vain. It was not in vain. So then we come to verse number 18. For the same cause also do ye joy and rejoice with me. So Paul is saying that in the same way, the Philippians should rejoice with Paul. If his imprisonment ends with his death. Now Paul talks about in this letter the concern that the Philippians had, and they were very concerned. They were concerned about Paul. They were concerned about Epaphroditus when it looked like that he was going to die in Rome. They had a lot of concern about these things. No doubt these things were grieving to them that Paul was suffering in the ways that he was, that Paul most likely is going to lead to his soon death. All of these things they were very concerned about. They were very grieved about. But Paul writes to them what many commentators refer to as the happiest letter in the New Testament, in this letter to the Philippians, where one of the continual themes is that of joy and rejoicing. And again, Paul modeled that from the very start. So what he's saying is, if I If I die in this service, I joy and rejoice with you all, and so should you. So should you, Philippians. So Paul here he's not excluding sorrow. He's not saying that would not be grievous. No doubt they will weep when Paul dies. He's not excluding that. They will experience that at Paul's death, and he understands that. But if they truly have the mindset of Jesus Christ, they will also rejoice in the ministry and the offering of Paul's life. In other words, they will thank God and they will be moved to emulation of Paul, that they have this same mind. And that's the aim of Paul's ministry to them, and it's the aim of Paul's prayer for them. He is going to die in joy in Jesus Christ, and he wants them to as well. So Paul has charged the church at Philippi with some hard realities about humility and unity. And as a Christian, as a member of a local church, at some point, you will have to joyfully lay aside your own ideas and your own opinions and submit to the congregation for the sake of the gospel and the good of your own soul. Now, let me clarify that I'm not talking about submitting to a congregation that denies the deity of Jesus Christ. I'm not talking about submitting to a congregation that denies the Trinity and the Godhead or something like that. But the purpose of a local church is to give corporate witness of Jesus Christ and his gospel to the nations until he returns. And so Paul has shown how that we cannot have true witness while we have pride, while we have selfish ambition, while we have high thoughts of our own opinions, while we have complaints, and while we have fights within. Having unity as a congregation for the sake of the gospel means that we can't hold individually our own ideas as superior to everyone else's. But more than this, true unity comes from having the mindset of Jesus Christ. So we saw how we came toward the end in this passage. Having unity is not just a nice feature. It's not just something that would be nice to have. You know, sometimes you go maybe shopping for a car, and of course they're always trying to upsell you. Look at all these features. Look at all these things. And I don't know why I would need to know the barometric pressure in China, but hey, that's a nice feature to have. It's not just an optional accessory to the Christian life. I mean, Paul has shown that true unity is rooted in humility that comes only from having the mind of Jesus Christ, who emptied himself. So it's not something that can be had, cannot be had. No, it's a necessity. Lacking it derails witness, but it also manifests unbelief. In other words, we see from what Paul has written here that this is what it means to follow Jesus. This is what it means to be like Jesus. This is what it means to think like Jesus. And it isn't optional.